Kunstraum, der Podcast vom Kunstraum Niederösterreich.
Hi and welcome to our fourth podcast episode this year. My name is Friederike Sperling and I'm the Artistic Director at Kunstraum Niederösterreich. In the framework of their solo exhibition Tomb, we invited the artist collective Omsk Social Club to discuss some of the thematic tropes from the show with Paul Feigefeld, Professor for Cultures of Knowledge in the Digital Age. This public conversation took place at Kunstraum Niederösterreich on the day after the opening of Tomb. Omsk Social Club is a Berlin-based collective founded in 2016. Their immersive practice focuses on the creation of shared experiences and speculative fictions. Omsk Social Club have presented their work in various institutions, galleries, theatres and offsites across Europe, including the Martin Gropiusbau, the HKW, the Volksbühne, HEC, 17 Gallery, Strom, but also the 34th Ljubljana Biennial as well as the 6th Athens Biennial. Paul Feigefeld holds the Professorship for Cultures of Knowledge in the Digital Age at the Institute for Design Research at the Braunschweig University of the Arts and teaches at the University of Basel. He studied cultural studies and computer science at Humboldt University zu Berlin. Until his death in 2011, he was assistant to Friedrich Kittler at the Chair for Aesthetics and History of Media. In 2019, he was the guest curator of the Vienna Biennial with the exhibition Uncanny Values, Artificial Intelligence and You at MAC.
Thanks for the invitation. Hello, everyone. We're going to try to have a little conversation about Omsk's work in general and this show in particular, which for those of you who have seen it already, will have become clear that it's a very multi-layered show. So we met in Berlin actually even before Omsk came into being, but it felt like back then in Berlin many of us were sort of witnessing the becoming of Omsk somehow. Back then I remember it felt a little bit like there was something in the air and there were like nobody really knew what Omsk was about, but it became, it was never clear whether it was founded or it just came into being naturally. So maybe you can give us a little insight how the collective formed, who is part of the collective, how real the people are who are part of the collective or entities, fictional.
How rude.
No, I think it's always felt to me that it's sort of part of your practice, that it's not entirely clear from the outside who you are, who does what, and whether it's all humans or other forms of characters and entities.
Yeah, I mean, we can definitely say it's not all human. So, Social Club came into being, actually, I think, yeah, definitely not in a straightforward manner. It was situated sort of at the crossroads of many different disciplines that were running simultaneously in like lines of inquiry, that were overlapping, some of which had a very specific artistic, technological, political trajectory. So it was heavily also inspired by projects such as On Monastery, which was initiated by Ben Vickers. Simultaneously, it was also very heavily inspired by belonging and living within Black Bloc and anarchist communities in Berlin at the time. And also through the illegal rave scene, not only in Berlin, but also across the UK, where it became, I think, more solicited, this idea of how you maintain or collectively narrate a world. Maybe some of you have been part of the rave scene that's, I think, you know, is probably similar across the globe, but this notion of, you know, how you do everything in order to maintain the moment of the evening. Everything becomes a shared resource. The way in which emotions that are spilled on the dance floor or like sitting on the edge of a toilet cubicle, they hurt as well as they're euphoric. And this notion of, you know, shared water, the shared soggy, shitty tobacco that you were like passing around just in order to continue to put your body through a sort of anti-capitalist state, to render the soul and the mind and the corporal body unable to kind of participate in our maybe more societal world. And so at the time, of course, like, it wasn't really understood that all these things were building or pooling into Omsk Social Club. But it kind of came naturally in a way to begin to think about how do we open up a certain way of being together that not only allowed us to question principles or ideas that are either portrayed in our sort of everyday life or in the near future, how do we practice them in these very sort of intense spaces rather than through the lens of academia, where actually you can also see the sort of splintering of the very essence of a human being, because quite often when we try to approach these difficult subjects through the lens of academia or sort of public-facing space, we're always kind of on our best behavior, and we often don't let like the difficulties that will naturally come up when we begin to sort of live in these environments. And role play became, for Omsk Social Club, the tool that allowed both investigation, but on a sort of spectrum of decency, in a way. Saying that it was also very much practiced with a lot of codes of conduct, the notion of safe spaces. And so I guess that's also why we called the works real gameplays. They do originate and definitely sit within the auvers of role-playing. You can also find like a line or a thread to live-action role-play. But I think what we understood was we were doing something different to role-play and LARP. LARP, live-action role-play, typically manifests with a game master and a sort of trajectory or script that over the course of the weekend or however long the sort of gaming space is open, that a certain amount of events will unfurl. And that's not really what we wanted to do. We didn't want to create a sort of script nor a reenactment. We wanted to actually question and find new lines of inquiry through these worldings. And what we also wanted to do was to work in a place called Bleed, which was heavily disputed by most role-playing and LARP communities. And Bleed is sort of the corridor or the space between a fictional world and consensual everyday reality. And this sort of chasm between it is where Bleed lies. And we really wanted to situate these worlds inside that corridor. And the reason why was to be able to bring things from our everyday in and to bring things from the fiction in and allow them to mesh and entwine. And also with the hope of being able to bring relics and ideas and intentions out of this fiction space into our everyday reality. This is also, I think, why a lot of those original places of interest that I mentioned, such as the illegal rave scene or the Black Bloc or political action, technological, decentralized open source technology, you know, they don't necessarily always sit within the arts, but there was a kind of belief that what art gave to this practice was something very valuable, and to really sort of understand art as a space or a test bed where things can actually leak out into society and have the ability to form mimetic structures to people that wouldn't necessarily turn up to a demonstration or field at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's a little bit the point I was trying to hint at when I spoke about the notion that I perceive about Omsk as an entity, is that it also exists in this bleeding space where one reality bleeds and blends into the other one. The topics that you've been engaged with over the past couple of years, they seem to require a multifaceted approach. Because we deal with a very complex world, very complex problems that are all interlinked and intertwined somehow. How does this transdisciplinarity factor in the group that Omsk is comprised of? And also another question that I didn't ask or wasn't answered yet, has the group been the same from the beginning, or is it changing in its setup?
So some people have been there from the very, very beginning. Mm-hmm. And it works sort of in a decentralized, sprawling way. And this is both for the transdisciplinary gesture that you speak of. So when we open these worlds, there are often also lines of inquiry that are set within the individual's line of interest. That also means, for example, when we've built things that needed code to be written, you know, then somebody who was already a programmer would then be involved in that iteration. So it's also based on skill set. And this is also a sort of reflection of what resources are available to the project itself. So depending on what the institution has to offer in terms of budget, facilities, and so forth, is really how big the group can get. And that's also a sort of reflection on the way, which is, you know, not unique to Om Social Club, but the way in which it's much more difficult for a collective to survive than it is an individual artist. And this is both like a historical formation, it's also an economic, and also how do you provide that level of care, which, you know, scalability, you often lose care. So it's taking into account often all of these nodes, and then when we sort of understand the boundaries of what can be offered, that's generally also where we facilitate the size of the group and what we want to investigate. And in terms of this piece particularly, so there was 10 of us in total, and this required a really deep level of inquiry and understanding, and also because we were removing common language, there needed to be a lot of pre-prep as well. So we did quite a lot of workshops, also lines of investigation before we even like began to make the work as well. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, it did. Before I want to go more into what we're actually seeing and experiencing here today, one last question about your practice in general. How would you say these shared practices and the transdisciplinary experiences that are created through these practices bleed back or translate back into the sort of mother disciplines where they come from? Because that's a process that I've been very interested in, how, especially in recent years, and with people who you probably also know, like Das Neumann or Marguerite Humeau or people from the Critical Engineering Group, practices start to emerge that I have a hard time defining. I wouldn't call them art, I wouldn't call them science or research or philosophy, but it's and it's sort of futile to find a new definition for it, but there is a field of investigation opening up, I have the feeling, that's entirely new because new worlds require new approaches, I guess. But how do you perceive the feedback personally or within the group of people who work with you? And how do they go back? Do they go back changed into their old disciplines? And is there a feedback, or do the sort of back channels remain one way?
No, I think there's definitely a feedback. I think the two examples that you gave are really brilliant in terms of, there's like how artist practices are brokering new space and new conversations. And I think that's also many of the people who are involved within OMSC, they also have external practice and they become specialized in certain lines of inquiry and they're called upon, that then sort of interfaces with the worldings and fictions that we've created. I think this is also, I totally agree with you. I think that there is a very new formation of art that is coming into the arena. I think this is also due to the fact that, and maybe this is a sort of the conversations that were evolving around 2017, 2018, where it became very, very obvious that a lot of political work within sort of a European context, it needed to be funded and it needed to have a sort of interface and dialogue external to the community who were investigating it. And art seemed to be like a very undervalued resource in terms of what could be done within the field of art and what could be supported within the field of art. And I think that since then we've seen artists brokering like entirely new forms of practice. There's a lot of care work, there's a lot of social work that's done in the space. There's a lot of collaborative efforts and force that is coming out of the art scene. And that could be due to the work itself, but I think it's also due to the fact that artists' mindset is a much more intersectional framing, and that in a way where many people are beginning to see that art is somewhat of a soft space to be able to exist and manifest, because I think often often in culture we're kind of written off. We're not like under a magnifying glass. But I think also it's very interesting in terms of Project Cassandra that really shows the potential of culture and how it has the ability of disruption. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Speaking of which, Project Cassandra, the show Tomb that we're in tonight is very much concerned with concepts of language. Interestingly, opening in Vienna, the birthplace and longtime residency of Ludwig Wittgenstein, who's been an inspiration for your show, whose concept is probably familiar with most of you, said, die Grenzen meiner Sprache bedeuten die Grenzen meiner Welt, but also developed like a very, very formalized philosophy of language and the so-called Sprachspiele language games. You mention it in the text to the exhibition, but you also hint at the role that language plays in defining realities and the way that it can be instrumentalized both by art but also apparently by the military. So maybe you can give us a little insight into the foundation of Project Cassandra and how it factors into the development of Tomb as a show.
So maybe it's also, sort of underscores the point that I was trying to make between Bleed. So Project Cassandra was a project that was started in 2017 at the Tübingen University in connection and partnership with the German military. And what they did there was they created investigations where they looked at different moments of uprisings, in Kosovo, in Africa, and so forth. And they had captured a sort of set of books that they felt, or literature that they felt had sort of forked into these uprisings, or they'd become very instrumentalized through these books. And they created from this data set a score system. And through that scoring system, it was things like whether the author or the book was censored, whether awards were awarded.
That's what they do.
Yes. Whether there was scandals around it, whether there was scarcity or availability of the text. And from that, they created the scoring system, and the higher the score, the more dangerous the text. And what was kind of a little bit concerning about this research group we found out about Project Cassandra maybe a year and a half ago or something like that, and it kept coming up or like on our radar of like, oh, we wanted to do something about it. And what was the kind of conversations around it was, firstly, it's kind of problematic, I think, for a German nation state to be involved in monitoring the uprisings of other countries' communities, not really registering even whether the government that was in power was good for the community or not. They were just simply understanding it as these sort of radical moments. And the other thing was that, which is maybe also like a little bit of sort of dark humor, which I'm British, so when the world's burning, like we make a joke out of it, is this notion, of course, of the ghostwriter as well. And so, if you can ghostwrite a celebrity's autobiography, who says you can't ghostwrite a sort of cybernetic uprising and also create a certain theatrical or role-played sentiment around that to actually induce the event. So also making a little bit of, a sort of dark humor to the practice itself, playing on the notion of role-play as a disruptor. And also many of you might know of people like George Soros, are often told by the sort of far right that they're actually paying people to role play demonstrations across the globe. The latest one is the climate change activists. Less Generation, yes, thank you. So recently the Last Generation have been sort of accused of being actually role-playing. And so we tried to sort of take all of these sort of speculations into consideration when beginning to set the scene for the tombs.
Mm-hmm. Interesting enough, you told me that they didn't do it for German literature.
No.
Which I find very interesting. And would have been funny to know what the scores of the Austrian literature, for example, would have been compared to German literature in post-war Germany. So this having set the stage or sort of bleeding into the games or the worlds that you've developed for Tomb, can you tell us a little bit about what we see here, the different characters, their respective languages and their attempts at communication with each other?
So with these worlds, they're often sort of as complicated as our own. They're by no means solutionist or utopic. There is simultaneously problems and things that are left unanswered. But the framework that we envisaged for Tomb is also quite similar to sort of monastic framework. When you visit these very old monasteries, there's typically a group of scholars there, some of which often say they don't even believe in God any longer. They're just there trying to unpack the questions that are surrounding belief and language and determine spirituality. And so inside these monasteries, there is quite often these kind of conflicting notions of inquiry, but they stand together as a community who live and work as scholars in the monasteries. So we use that template to produce the tombs. So this is one tomb, or one set of scholars. There's many tombs across the globe. They work as almost sort of nomadic scholars. So scholars spend different time in different tombs. So they're sort of an interconnected node of linguists. And this particular tomb is about 5 hours away from Berlin. And they were approached by a group of independent filmmakers to try to create a documentary on their practices at the tomb. And this initially sort of sent a few vibrations through this group of scholars, because they were sort of feeling a little bit critical about the notion of documentary filmmaking and the idea that it often comes from a single narrator, and that often the people inside of this reality projections don't have much say in how they're going to be portrayed. So they went through a series of meetings to work out how this would actually unfurl, where they were on the same level and a sort of pluralistic documentary style could be created. And so these are the five identities that live within this tomb. So you have Aria in the blue frame. Aria often works with the notion of vibrations and specifically looking at how movement shifts, and you can see vibrational glyphs on water, but they also understand it in terms of somatics and energy and how the body reacts. Aria is also quite an interesting character in terms of the fact that they are quite conspiratorial, or they're quite kind of paranoid, but they decided that instead of being like lost in this sort of toxic world of distrust, they would try to bring about their line of inquiry to work in a more than human way. Then you have Eden next to. Eden is actually two characters or identities. It's a 7-month-old fetus and themselves. What you will also notice within the film documentary is you can also hear the heartbeat and the movement that's taken from inside the stomach, so there's kind of a continual conversation. This is their line of inquiry is very much about thinking about when or who gets the ability to speak, and also really sort of investigating this notion of language being a sort of a prison in effect, that obviously we have a kind of common language that's already been raised today, that you know, there, when we speak in these languages of our nationality, we often remove certain people, or that can be through a lack of being able to understand or be able to speak. But also simultaneously, I think it's about whether you even have access to those types of vocabulary or that type of information, which is also maybe a tiny detour, but brings me onto the Acemic writing, which you can see under each portrait. Now, the Acemic writing is a type of writing that's practiced globally. You can also see it on the wall drawings here. And Acemic writing is borderless. It reflects often more emotional insignia. And interestingly enough, when they've done studies on Acemic writing across the globe, that we typically have a much more aligned method of writing Acemically across all human beings than we do when we speak within our nation states. So this character is kind of questioning a lot about how language develops, and also, of course, when you give birth, you then begin to repeat these language prisons that we have effectively been trained under. And of course, it's not as simple as that, that you choose not to repeat certain ideas, because the ideas are embedded indefinitely within the languages we speak. Then we have Hollis, who maybe is the most traditional scholar in a certain way. They very much are interested in the notion of linguistics and the history of it. However, they say that after spending time in the tomb, they often speak of this notion of misreadings, and all of their work over the course of living in the tomb is about mistranslation and misreadings, and how that is sort of paradoxical both. And this line of inquiry is through multiple common languages. And also, Hollis, in a way, brings all of the languages that are evolving in the tomb into a sort of archival resonance. Then you have Skylar. Skylar works with sonic glyphs, which very much speaks to Skylar's kind of antisocial, but also very sort of deep trancing perspective on language. And then you have Lennox at the end, who basically understands that the modus of her investigating her language is a kind of a continual abolition. So Lennox often dies. In fact, Lennox dies every day. And so we always have to assist Lennox with their funeral. As they go through these kind of different layers and sediments of the death of language and the death of their social structures. And in a way, each character doesn't recognize themselves to be developing a new language, but actually to be building on a intergenerational language of both their own experience and the socio-political experiences of everyday life. And They also play with, like, I'm sure everybody's familiar with, like, tandems. So when, you know, English-German tandems and so forth. And so they also practice these spaces where they work in tandem together and try to find iterations to teach each other the languages. They also transcribe for each other. So there's kind of like this mediated space between both individual and collective practices that go on throughout the course of their everyday lives.
What I would like to get into a little bit more is, I mean, what I find most interesting is the language aspect of the whole thing. At first, I sort of had a different idea of their respective languages. I thought they weren't able to communicate, actually. Mm. So everyone had their very unique language that was only spoken by one individual, which I found very interesting as the idea of hyper-individualization in society these days. But what they do have in their Islamic writing, this is their very unique fingerprint, right? Yeah. The translatability of their language, but also the translatability of thinking into language, into writing. How would you describe this sort of triangle process in the individual characters, but also in the group or ensemble of people in the tomb? Is every player also their own tomb? Are they sort of closed up from each other, or do they have a way of communicating with each other that is functional, or is it something that we don't know whether it's actually working because we have this notion that communication is very unlikely, you know? Mm. That even though when we sit here and we talk about the same thing, there is only a certain degree of communication that is actually noiseless.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, I can only really say from my perspective, but I would say that they do manage to communicate together. I think you can also see that, like, within the film, that they do find rhythm, and they, in a way, there is this kind of very deep, I think, passion to be able to understand each other. Whether or not that's understanding in the rational way of, like, I understand the question that you asked me, but there's something else that's going on, this sort of metaphysical notion of understanding, which, you know, we also do have. The sort of quickest example that comes into my mind is, like, you know, when you catch a stranger's eye and you assume they're thinking the same thing as you're thinking after something has just occurred. And, like, often it's maybe a sort of silently shared joke or something like that. It felt like that in the house. Mm-hmm. There was also codes and rules that they had. So, for example, if you could only speak in common language unless there was somebody from outside the tomb. So when the documentary filmmaking group entered, they used common language. But previous to that, you could only use common language when you needed to know a certain piece of information. And that common language would be a sort of question, and it could only have a yes or no answer. So most of the time inside the house you could barely hear common language being spoken, which was also kind of interesting in terms of, like, they had this quite strict timetable that they lived by, that was created through different compartments of, like, self-learning, self-study, or collective learning, which was actually set up through various different alarm systems that went off. So they had also sort of built these mechanics around their living together where they didn't actually have to speak unless it was in their own sort of shared language that they were building. And how they understand the tombs is they're not individual, they don't individually resonate tombs. But they feed into an archival tomb. And they also believe that the tombs can be opened and practiced and shared. And what they sort of hope, especially with this sort of different nodes of the tombs that are across the globe, that eventually there will become a new linguistic way of communicating, but that it won't be as heavily situated within the notion of the rational, which I think is, yeah, it's very interesting what you said, because, you know, when we speak together, we assume understanding. I mean, even me, I'm trying to tell you about this very irrational thing in like the most rational language right now, which is like, yeah, maybe that sort of underpins it.
I mean, speaking about metaphysics maybe a little bit, that's and also the notion of the tomb that for me raises questions of, you know, death and resurrection, about mysticism, about spiritualism or spiritism. And when you enter these liminal spaces between the real and the play or the game, you enter a cultural history of whether you would call it world-making or production of reality or simulation models or the invocation of demons or spirits or realities that you want to sort of wish into reality through ritualistic means. So I feel that plays a very large part also in your practice and also in this particular work. Yeah. The idea of practices that create realities. What inspirations do you draw on when we look at these glyphs, when we look at sort of these écriture automatique things that, that could have been written by spirits, could have been written by the unconscious or whatever?
I mean, I think what's very deep rooted in the practice of Social Club and all the practitioners is this strong belief of, to open a world, you have to sacrifice and you have to call on things that we wouldn't necessarily be able to rationalize in our everyday world in order to open or to create a passageway into that. I think that's maybe also a little bit why these works don't necessarily sit within like traditional formations of LARP, because what we typically pull on is much sort of deeper level of meditations, trance. We don't do so much sort of method acting work, but instead go into journeying. You know, the leading forefront of sigil magic and probably the earliest Asemic work, Osman Spare, who I think is also a really interesting example to open up, because in a way Spare was like the first person to sort of open source magic. Like previously to that, like you had to have like all these sacred special tools, you had to be pretty much male, and like you know, it was very much the Masonic era, and so forth. And like he was a total outsider, and he lived with his cats and began to create this like almost keyboard of energetic world and will. And he was also an incredible painter as well. Like I can't remember the story, but it's like something like he won a prize from the National Portrait Gallery at like 13 years old or something like that. And he released these zines of how people could basically practice sigil making to bring forth new realities and new worldings. This, I think, also heavily connects into chaos magic, which was a similar principle, but using the World Wide Web in order to create different node systems and will and bring communities together to create...
And get Trump elected.
Chaos magicians didn't get Trump elected. That was QAnon. Like, another form of meme magic.
LARPing.
But chaos magician was before meme magic. Like, thankfully, we have Lana Del Rey, though, who can create the hex on Trump. You know, there's like all this going around. But yeah, I think definitely there. Yeah, it's somehow a ritual of making the work. It's not the. I think probably every artist has these ways that they enter. Not even every artist. Come on, that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Every maker mm-hmm. has these ways that they enter into the space. And yeah, you're right to see that they have a historical lineage towards them.
Speaking about the role of technology in your work and in this work in particular, if we look back at the relationship of technologies and their creative outputs, we often find that in the very early stages of some technological development, there is a higher degree of a spiritual reading of the respective technologies. So in the early days of photography, for example, when the technology was just very flawed still, you would have lots of blurry figures appearing. So people naturally assumed that with the new technology, they were able to actually reach out into a different sphere, into another reality, maybe into the beyond or whatever. So we will find this in radio, we will find this in telegraphy, we will find it in photography and film. Do you think the reason why spiritual and mystical practices are on the rise again and are being reflected in art today has to somehow reflects a state of development in the technological condition?
Maybe in the way that I wonder. I wonder, just like off the top of my head, with like this very difficult question, the state of sort of technological development and why we feel more confident to bring in these positions might be due to the fact that we are stepping away from the individual as like the genius structure.
Hopefully.
Like, and that instead we're understanding that ideas, which is interesting in terms of fiction, I think, because quite often you'll hear the idea that to bring a world forth, it has to appear in somebody's mind, first of all, or that many fictions actually bring forth the world, and they do that through a sort of web of players or actors. I think you can see it most fundamentally if you read sci-fi from like the 70s and 80s, and then you look at Silicon Valley and you see that it's a fan fiction made real. And that
that's the idiotic part about it, and like cyberspace, a completely dystopic notion. Let's do it.
Like, you know? Yeah,
we should do it.
It
metaverse.
Sounds exciting.
Let's go for it,
like,
right? Yeah.
I think also, you know, I mean, but also, like, you know, it goes far even further back, right? Like, you know, seances, they were typically led by very strong anti-establishment female figures. Who could, you know, communicate with the dead. maybe seances were like the first telephones.
And well, there's a reason both of these are called media, you know?
Yeah.
Incidentally, also, the group, the Wiener Kreis, the Vienna Circle of Logical Positivists that Wittgenstein also belonged to, had their own investigative practice to weed out spiritualism in Vienna, which made them, they had to attend seances, you know? So there's an interesting translation also between these fields of hardcore logicism that brings forth the entire philosophy of computation and lays the foundational work for making thought computable in any way, and the spiritual. And it's very funny to read the records of these investigations. It's somehow like porn hunters, you know, people who are like, we have to look at it. I really don't want to, but just to make sure no one else does it. Also, I mean, I have a hypothesis on the question of why these practices might become interesting again today. Is because, of course, we have built planetary computational systems that are very, very capable of and doing nothing else but world making and producing realities nonstop. And we have very successfully outsourced rationality to machines. So these other forms of practices might become the last refuge of the scoundrel again.
Yeah.
Somehow. Welcome to the real world.
All right. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you on Social Club, and thank you on Heidelberg.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was nice.